Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 5th, 1998. In the Creekside Room this morning is the presenter Karen Bloomquist. Today's session titled, Towards Sufficient, Sustainable Livelihood for All, Sufficiency. Let's listen in.
I'm Karen Bloomquist, and I think I've seen all of you around, so I don't have to introduce myself again, that's probably. I would encourage us to maybe pull a little bit closer in. There may be others who will come. Part of the reason I'd like us to be close is all of these tapes are being recorded, of course. But the next two, three sessions I'm especially interested in because I intend to take these tapes back to Chicago and to glean some of the wisdom that you share on them. So speak up and, in other words, this really is a kind of chance for you to share some of your ideas, your critiques of some of what we will be going through in this first draft, your additions, suggestions, and I really want us to spend a lot of time talking and going with the kinds of ideas that you all have. Let me just see who, I know somebody picked this up. If you have another one already, please return it at the end, but you can borrow this one. Yesterday or last evening, we spent a while going through kind of the kind of theological, biblical bases for talking about and seeing ourselves as Christians in some kind of tension with some of the common economic assumptions. Now we're going to turn to page 7 in this particular document. And I want to say a little bit, first of all, about the focus on the theme of livelihood. As the task force was working on this and on this earlier study, which of course has the word livelihood in it also, we hit upon livelihood in its comprehensive meaning being a part of what, as people of faith, we really want to focus on. And so if you look in the middle of page 7, that first paragraph under livelihood, what's listed under there are the variety of things that we mean here. I think for many of us, when we think livelihood, immediately it's the job that I have or don't have. And much of the rest of this section deals with what is needed to adequately prepare people for jobs, to see that there are adequate jobs, to see that there's human dignity, in terms of the jobs that people have. But it begins with this more expansive notion, and it's a way of saying, hey, livelihood is something we all need. Livelihood has to do with how we are supported economically, which might include our paid, which for most of us probably for much of our life means a paid job. But it might also include business ownership, self-employment, accumulated wealth, as well as being supported by family, community members, government assistance, human service organizations, all that array of, that whole array of ways being means through which we realize or don't realize some kind of livelihood. And then the final sentence there, everyone requires a means of livelihood if they are to live. And a basic kind of conviction then that comes out of our faith. We are called to exercise responsibility for our livelihood and to pursue possibilities of livelihood for others. I'm going to just very quickly touch on some of the items that come up under the next section. And then what I'd like you to do is to think of comments, suggestions, critiques, examples that you have. In other words, I'm going to just lay out some things and then invite you to kind of get in a conversation around some of the things that are here. So, turning from that broad understanding of livelihood to a somewhat narrow understanding of livelihood as it has to do with jobs. First of all, on the top of page 8, there's a bolded sentence that I think one could think of as a kind of aspiration. And I'd like us to just think about this, whether this is an idealistic platitude or whether in fact this is the content we as a society should in fact be striving toward. The quest for productive justice, you'll recall last night I was talking about how productive justice means using what we have in order to be productive in human community. In other words, that we are involved in producing what we need to create. That quest challenges us to assure that all adults able to work have access to ongoing life-enhancing jobs that utilize their gifts or abilities. Any comment or response to that? Do you agree with it? Is it realistic?
Well, it's very idealistic, but that doesn't make it wrong. It certainly, in some ways, for me, it makes it more right. It's human dignity. It has to do with who we are as human beings and having opportunities to be ourselves in our society. That's idealistic.
I think one of the critiques that could be raised at that point is, well, life-enhancing jobs, doesn't that overlook that there's some jobs that are just plain cruddy, and yet they're essential jobs, they're jobs that need to be done. But I think it also then raises another question, even if one's talking about, the cleaning the toilet kinds of jobs and the other kinds of jobs that are essential for are living together and that somebody's got to do. You know, how do we treat with dignity all people, no matter how, what the nature of those jobs is? And does this simply mean that everyone has to have a job, which, is kind of fulfilling? And, those of us who are fortunate enough to be in kind of professional jobs can say, oh, yeah, my job's life enhancing. What about those for whom that's not possible?
Well, and I think, again, there's every job is, if we treat it with respect, or the rest of us treat it with respect, the fellow that does the job, it can be fulfilling. I knew a fellow that wanted to drive a garbage truck from the day he was 5 or 6 years old until he got, and that's what he wanted to do. Now, I can't imagine that myself, but yet you have to respect the fellow for wanting to do that job, even though it wasn't one that I would consider. He was a good fellow. I mean, he worked hard in order to make himself available for that job.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
Well, we need firefighters, and we need railroad engineers, and we need whatever, and farmers and ranchers or whatever, but we also need those, like you say, those kind of guys. But each one that does that, we have to treat him with respect, and then the job is fulfilling, I believe.
I think, though, that begs the reality of many people's work experience today. I've been the director of an anti-poverty program for 13 years, so we're involved with welfare reform, and many of those women right now are not feeling like they're coming into life-enhancing jobs, and they're feeling very much, and I'm not saying that I disagree with the policy, but they are feeling very much pressured that they take what's available or they lose their ability to take care of their children, whether or not they like it, whether or not they feel skilled in it, whether or not they feel there's growth in those jobs.
But didn't we all start out like that? Didn't we all take, I did. I took jobs that I would prefer not to do, but it's part of where I gain skills to move on.
I think the problem is we live in a very class, not a classless society, but a very class-conscious society. We always think we move above. We move. We get out of it. And the point is that these jobs are not necessary. We shouldn't be. I mean, that's one of the problems. I don't know how to even put it in words.
Right. If in fact, an entry-level job as a dishwasher in a restaurant led you to have life experience, work experience that led to the next level, that would be fine. But for many of the folks that we work with, one job as a dishwasher leads to another job as a bus person, or the next job as a packer, or the next job earning minimum wage, so that there isn't a ladder. There's a life experience of jobs that are difficult.
That I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But why does that happen? Why do some people start out that way and move on, but then there's other people who can never, who can never get beyond this horizontal progression? Why is there a vertical progression and a horizontal progression? What's the difference between those two people?
Well, it, I mean, I think that that's a very complex answer. But but for some, I mean, there are some folks who, quite frankly, have neither gifts of intellect or skill or
ambition
or whatever that is, and that's just a piece of what we
or know somebody.
Let's move on, and it's a good beginning of this discussion. I think we'll want to come back to some of the kinds of situations that we begin to think about right now. The rest of this top of page 8 is mainly high employment. Now, that, I mean, certainly we're living in a time, at least in this country, where that's, if anything, a lot of companies are begging for workers, so that's, you know, in some ways, there's more possibilities of moving into jobs now than has been true, say, even 5 years ago. But the fact that we live in this, you know, constant transition of jobs, and that there's probably going to be more and more movement in that. When we had the listening pulse, and I did bring a copy of some of the things we heard 5 years ago on the listening pulse related to this. Probably the primary thing was that lack of security among especially middle class folks who could count on the job being there for the rest of their life. And now it's like, whoops, in and out, and how do we make these transitions? And I think there's a lot of challenges related to that as people move in and out of jobs. And then finally, there's another kind, I suppose we could say, an ideal set forth in lines 21 through 23. Does our work produce goods or services that lead towards life-enhancing ends, or are they jobs that destroy, harm, exploit either human beings or the natural environment? And I think much of the church's consideration of vocation and what does it mean to work, those often haven't been questions that have been raised. Now, in the last 2-3 decades ago, I think more and more questions were raised in terms of people who were producing bombs or whatever, and some ethical questions raised there. I think that whole question, and this isn't saying, well, thou shalt not work in those kinds of jobs, but how do we help one another think through those kinds of issues in terms of what is it that our work is producing? And is it a life-enhancing end, or is it something that is harming in some ways? Any comment on that?
Well, I'm one of those people who make bombs, and I worked ever for Hercules, and after working in that industry, we need rockets and all kinds of sidewinders, barrels. And after working in that for a period of time, I decided that that wasn't anything I could work in, so I left. Mm-hmm. But the other part of your question was, I think it's easy for a professional person who has some options to make a choice. I don't think it's as easy for the person who is dealing cards in the casino to make the choice of their jobs.
Especially if those are the only jobs around.
Yeah.
The generalizations are very tricky.
Very.
Preparing to work for livelihood. And feel free to just jump in as other thoughts occur as we're moving through this. I think it's important to recognize that the more policy directions that this draft is proposing very much begin the importance of work in people's lives and the importance of jobs for their livelihood. And in that sense, I think it may be a little different than where a lot of church bodies have started in some of the address of economic justice issues. I think it reflects our times, although that's not the only thing it says, and we'll get into what the rest of what it says very, very quickly. But it tries to look realistically at what are some of the institutional realities and it needed to be in place by, you know, and I'm, by institution, I mean family, neighborhood, community, et cetera. If, in fact, people are to be adequately prepared for jobs, in other words, I think there's a lot here that most of us, when we were growing up, could take for granted. Maybe not all of us. But, you know, that, yeah, there'd be a stable family life, there'd be a neighborhood that'd be there, there'd be good schools. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of those who are finding enormous challenges in pursuing their livelihood seem to don't have one or more of those things going for them. And I don't think this is just in terms of low-income areas. But if one looks at, you know, the breakup of families and the breakup of communities, including middle, upper middle class communities. And when we did this particular study, we set out some case studies in it. And the case study we used here for the, you know, the breakup of families and communities was not a low-income one, but a, if anything, a very affluent one, you know, where, you know, the family's not there because everybody's working and there's, you know, again, this phenomena of you've got to move every few years, etc. And I think as church, as Christians, it's important for us to say some clear words about the need for these, I suppose we could call them infrastructures, to be in place. So it says something about that. I think tomorrow we'll talk more about the community, and especially community economic development. But one of the things, for example, that's not in place in the way that it was when probably most of us grew up is all of the unpaid community building work and the fact that more women were not working outside the home. There was a little bit more time for that volunteer energy, whether it was at church or, you know, looking out for kids in the neighborhood. Et cetera, et cetera. And we need to realistically look at what's changed in terms of these wider factors that make it more complex than to just say, well, everyone should go out and get a job, et cetera. You know, there's a whole preparing for seeking livelihood that those preparatory realities are often far more fragile than they have been in the past. Any comments?
Well, sometimes I wonder if it wasn't part of a political process that made this more available too, like we want the government to do more for us. So then laws were put into place that the government was going to take care of things that normally the community took care of. And so it's a deliberate process whether we realize that what happened. And then there's a certain segment of society, I think, that believes that that's the way it should be. And of course, when then those things come into power or they have more, as you say, will to do what those kind of things, then all of a sudden we lose that. You know, it used to be family took care of a lot of things. Now that we expect Uncle Sam to take care of, and or we pay taxes so that can happen, or that's the way we get through it. And I think some of that entered in here, whether it was deliberate or it just happened, I'm not sure, but I think it happens.
I'm not an expert on this at all, but there was a woman here a few years ago, Holden, Stephanie Coates was her name, and she wrote a book called The Way It Never Was. Mm-hmm. And in that book, she goes through a lot of different data on how people who indeed made it on their own have very much in government help, but they're in stabilized programs that we take for granted, like housing for the veterans when they came out of World War II and out of the Korean conflict, or other kinds of government power, social security, we take that as for granted, that's government assistance too. So we need to maybe open our eyes to what kind of government assistance we're having in our lives and what we support and what we take for granted. Mm-hmm. We don't realize it's government support. You know, our tax deduction on our homes is another example. We all take that for granted.
Or is it what they call today corporate welfare?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That the move is always to cut back with the poor, but never with the rich. I mean, that's one of the main arguments in Congress today. And that big business and the whole thing we talked about last night, and we've been talking about all of these days that I've been here, is that, you know, the steel ball was rolling down the hill, and no one can stop it. And so so what we do is chip away at the poor, say people shouldn't be on welfare. But the billions and billions we give in tax incentives and so forth to big business, forge ahead, we take them granted. I mean, it's all the fortune.
So huge issues related to corporate welfare. Mm-hmm. Some of that will be at least alluded to here as we move through this. Finally, in this section, there's a lot given to education. I know some of you are involved in education, and I'd be really interested in some of your perspectives of maybe not just what is said here, but also what more needs to be said. Starting on page 9, especially lines 32 and following, the inequities in the funding of public education. Now, I think how this plays itself out in different states may vary. I know the inequity in school funding is a big issue in Illinois, where I live, and I think that's true in other states too, but not that funding itself is the key to the quality, but certainly part of the picture. But then some of the innovative partnerships that are emerging between businesses and nonprofit organizations, including sometimes congregations. Comments about what you see as especially helpful models of that. I don't know, Margarita, if the Life Direction program that you're part of would be an example of the kind of thing that should be given more emphases.
I think anything that trains any level of society for more self-direction is important. When I think about some of the earlier things that we were talking about up above on this page, we're talking about having fewer hours to do the kinds of neighborhood surveillance, support, attendance at school meetings, participation in local school boards, whatever it is. And it seems to me that a part of what congregations can do, in addition to perhaps a direct link to specific schools, would be to do more in terms of training individuals for participation. When we in the public schools have a local school council, we bring them out for training. When I was a new member as a teenager of a home mission church, I was sent for youth leadership training. I'm wondering, are we continuing in our congregations the type of training that will make, if we're looking for more individuals, because individuals are now working and have fewer blocks of hours to participate, are we as a church and as congregations encouraging people to do volunteer work, and then will this then extend into our focal schools and public schools? I mean, that's one issue. Formal programs. Earlier in the session, I was talking about Life Directions, which is a nonprofit movement started by a Roman Catholic priest. And this is a movement where trained individuals go into schools and work with troubled and goal-centered young people to facilitate dialogue among these students so that those that are goal-centered can present their success strategies, and the young people that have not yet become goal-centered can be challenged to look for a goal for their lives. And it has a component where the individuals working with these students go out and meet with the families. And it also has a component where the young people that are working in this program and have achieved success go down into the elementary schools and begin mentoring and preparing those students to come. But I'm wondering if, as I look at our public schools and the need for volunteers and so on, I would see that the church's role can be to create some of this activism and volunteer sense of capacity, sense of that I have the skills, I have the gifts, I have the talent, this is something I can do, and that as more individuals come into the local public schools and become active in their PTAs or their local school councils or whatever, that this is really empowering, and then these same individuals, in terms of their own livelihood, are going to speak up and try to empower themselves and others in terms of looking at the workplace and whether there's a union or whatever. And I see a lot of that going on. One thing that I did miss here in terms of linkages, for instance, the public schools now, we're linking with universities. And we're getting some of that best talent coming into our schools. And so I would say that there was a real place for our church, universities, and colleges to have a role.
Well, since you mentioned unions, again, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, I didn't see any mention of unions anywhere in this document.
No, there's a whole paragraph. There is. Whole next, page 10.
I just want to piggyback on what you're saying about schools. The church I'm at has been in its third year now, or fourth year. And we are involved in a tutoring program with one of the local schools. And the school board at first was horrified because we're not people from the church, the church is directly linked with the school. And the school board was very antsy about all this, but it's worked out beautiful. And we have a housing project getting cornered from the church in the poor area of the town, and those kids are bused across town to school. So for them to go to a tutoring program held at the school is unrealistic. There's no one has transportation. And so we have it at our church once a week, have volunteers come in. And now we're trying to develop ways we can help the families and so forth. But it's done in the name of the church. And we get a nice certificate, an IDO certificate every year from the school and so forth. And so it's possible as a church to bridge over some of these prejudices we have about separation of church from all these things, because the need is there. And it's being fulfilled, and it's being fulfilled in a way that is satisfying to everyone. Hopefully that sort of thing could happen, and much more.
I have a question before you jump to page 10. On 9 here, earlier one this morning in the Bible study, we were talking about the amount of space you provide for a certain, the amount of text, and one is 32 to 35. I'm in favor of that, and I agree entirely with those four lines. But then when you go into the last paragraph on the page there, the first one about supporting parochial schools, I have a little bit of a concern there, because that's a contentious issue right now in many states with people, let's say, in the higher classes wanting to support private schools and take the money away from the public schools. And it's a guise, really, for saying that we want to provide tax money into parochial schools because somehow they have an edge, or they know how better to educate, or they're providing different models, and indeed they are. And of course,
so are some public schools.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it was the same kind of arguments that went on, particularly in the South after segregation. All the private schools had started, and many of those were religiously affiliated schools, just to separate the races.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, that's only the. That parochial reference should only be that first sentence. I mean, in each of these,
right.
There's so many things put
together.
The rest
of the paragraph is, I like, but that first
that
one,
first
I'm a little worried.
Kind of stands out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's an ongoing kind of issue. A few years ago, our department produced a study on issues related to education and choice, because I think a lot of our public policy offices very much. Certainly in Wisconsin, which is where you're from, I know, Sue Larson there, who has real concern about what happens in terms of the funding of public education in the name of choice.
Right.
And I think there's some real legitimate concerns there. I think also, though, we're dealing in an era where, you know, there may, in some cases, be situations where that choice is a good thing, too. But how do we look at it in that wider spectrum when this means that therefore the public school has suffered, not only in terms of funding, but, the cream could be taken off from that, you know, and therefore the public school gets left with whoever doesn't choose to exercise that choice. I mean, there's some real justice issues here.
In Canada, where I was brought up, they have two separate school boards. They have a public school board and a separate school board.
Mm-hmm.
And if your child goes to a separate school board, you pay almost taxes to the separate school board. If you go to public school, you pay taxes to the public school. And there's two separate systems. And so, depending where your kid goes, that's where your money goes. And here, it's always like, if you take this one, you steal from that one, and you're always stealing one from the other. Or they have just a parallel system, and it seemed to work very well.
You said it was based on what the children were?
Yes.
What about those of us who have children all grown up and still pay?
I guess you split. You split.
Or would they be able to choose? Did they choose?
I think it's just where the parents decided where they wanted to send their kids, and they went there, and then the school boards assessed where your child went.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's still going on.
That's interesting.
They're not so hung up on separation of churches.
Right.
Yeah.
Let me just zero in on the top of page 10. These are really helpful comments. Coming up with some of that. I think that lines 5 through 8, I think in the face of a lot of what's happening in post-welfare reform, and I especially be interested in hearing that, but what is your name?
Sharon,
in terms of your work with anti-poverty programs. Again and again, I think there's a real narrow focus without realizing all of the supporting services that are needed in order to sustain someone in their job. I've heard of some job placement programs of, you know, some companies that have been very intentionally designed to provide ongoing personal support. And, you know, that's just the basic things that can keep one from coming to work. And how can those supportive services still be in place? And I think in different states it's being designed in different ways as to how much of that will still be available. That's part of what we're dealing with now, is it's such a varied situation across the country as to who's getting what. But at least there's a basic principle saying those other services and that follows through, and we need to be realistic. If in fact one does not come with all of the kind of background and support and institutional support that most of us in this room probably have, how can we as a society be much more realistic about what to do? Any comments along that line?
I think that speaks again to what you talked about earlier, which is the lack of the kind of community infrastructure available to many persons anymore. I mean, there aren't grandmas ready and available to take in the kids, or so many, I think, of the families that we work with that are transitioning from welfare do not have that kind of fallback. They don't have a parent to call for $20 if they're short, you know, on gas this week, or just that kind of safety network that I kind of took for granted as maybe an 18-year-old just isn't there or available. And I think, ironically, that probably the strongest and most important role of the church is to provide that sense of hopefulness that I think you cannot get in any way that's focused on program. Mm. As a secular institution, we struggle around whether someone has hope in their life or not, probably as the single biggest barrier, and I don't know how you give that except through a spiritual connection. And in fact, those programs that help bridge people into church communities then find a community of support that can provide them both hope and help.
Yeah, and I think there's much more public discussion today than might have been true a few years ago about church-related social services. And by that I mean not so much, you know, obviously, in terms of Lutheranism, Lutheran social services provide a lot of that, but the kind of faith-based, so that part of the support group, et cetera, are some faith understandings, and for the most part, in our Lutheran agencies, on a faith basis as to why they're doing what they're doing, that's usually not part of the treatment or the service provided. In other words, you don't have to listen to a sermon in order to get the participant in the soup kitchen kind of thing. And of course, some of us might cringe at the idea of, you know, some of these groups that require and you've got to preach to first before you get the handout. And I'm not necessarily afraid of that, but I think some of the other programs that now there's more and more studies saying that if we're taught, you know, whether it's dealing with various kinds of addictions or other human needs, that that faith component is part of the healing and the progressing beyond the situation.
And another item under there, I don't know if it's addressed in the document somewhere else, but you mentioned here housing on line 8 is one of those things needed for this particular targeted group of people, perhaps. More and more, we've become separated in society by gated communities. People are opting to live in retirement homes. People are self-selecting out of the rest of society to do that. How can we, as living in society, even recognize these items we mentioned in here for separating ourselves away from these people and deciding to live away from them? Seems to me the church should be saying, it isn't right to be doing this. We need to maintain a society for all people.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, that phenomenon is not specifically addressed here. It was brought up in this particular one. But I think that the theological understanding of we are created to live in community, mm-hmm. as part of and in touch with the whole household of God. And all those ways in which, in the name of individualism, and I've got my right and I'm going to protect myself from the rest of the world. And to me, that's so much a part of so much of what we breathe in this society that contributes to that. But I think the irony of it is that some of places where the church establishes new congregations are to serve those gated communities.
Mm-hmm. And it was the churches that originally started to build the retirement homes and facilities to gather those who were felt that they needed to be part of a community. You see, the same argument that we say separates them is also the same argument that
they create a new community leads to new barriers and new ways of cutting ourselves off from others. Mm-hmm.
So it's more complex. It's subtle.
I think one of the, you know, unless of course one's in a congregation that's in one of these isolated communities and therefore everyone in it is from there, I think in a lot of cases, the local congregation becomes a place where people from very different kinds of local community contexts can have the possibility of being together, depending, obviously, on the location of the congregation. But we do have that possibility of not, you know, the intergenerational, the cross-economic lines. I mean, to me, that's when the church is most fully embodying what it means to be the body of Christ in all its diversity and not a kind of, according to some kind of homogenous principle.
I know a woman who probably is the best salesperson for joining a retirement community, and she said she wanted to join the retirement community. She was young enough to make herself known and have roots and a community outside of that, in the general community. She's always been a social activist. She's out there in the soup kitchen. She's doing all these things. She's involved in community. And she says, as I get older and become less able physically to do this, I'll also have this other community, but I want to get there. And she sees her church-related retirement home as part of a bigger community. And she's a good salesperson for this, because she does it in her life. She lives what she says she lives. But it's a hard issue.
I want to move on to this number three section, because it is where, among other things, the right of workers to organize is affirmed. In a sense, this is not a new position for us as a church body, but it's, as some of you heard last night, particularly because I happen to be on the National Board of the Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice, which sees itself as an attempt to talk about the importance of unions and the labor movement in relationship to religious communities. It's something I feel pretty strongly about. And yet, I think part of the way this is worded the way it is we recognize there's many circles of our church and many churches, some real resistance. I mean, I think that the kind of backlash against unions, the fact that 15% if at most of the workforce is unionized, and certainly there's been a mixed bag. I mean, there's good things as well as, unions don't always have some bad things associated with unions, and that's one of the reasons why it says here, accurate information and fair tactics are expected of all parties. This is quite frankly where we as church, the issue hits us in terms of the Lutheran Church, and now I'm talking ELCA and Missouri Synod. There are between 250 and 300 Lutheran social service organizations, many of them in the area of health care, many of them with low-paid workers, and the whole challenge of how do we talk about labor practices in our own institutions that provide services, especially when many of them are heavily dependent on government funding, which gets cut back. 57%, the average that our Lutheran social service organizations, on the average, 57% of their income is from government funds. And some is close to 90%. And of course, many of those funds either have been cut back or there's huge delays in getting paid and then, how to run those operations, etc. So I want to at least acknowledge that wider reality and some of the dilemmas that raises for these institutions. But at the same time, this is saying, yes, that right to organize needs to be respected. At the same time, employers need to do whatever they can to include employees more fully in decision-making, but recognizing that at times that falls short of what is needed.
I see nothing in there about kind of the new practice of partnering or partnerships between corporations and workers, in which the corporation will encourage workers to, say, get stock, or for bonuses they give them stock in the company. And so then the owners begin to feel like there's an ownership. I mean, the workers feel an ownership rather than just being some guy who comes to work. And it seems to me that it's been very promising in some areas of industry. Mm-hmm. That shouldn't also be.
Yeah. There's a little bit more discussion here that whether it is that exact phrase talked about that. And then a little bit later when it deals with the whole matter of the quote, overcompensation of many of the large CEOs. I mean, the figure I quoted last night that it's 200 times what the average worker makes. Can we at least move towards some proportional benefit to all? And I think prevent workers having a greater stake in, you know, the profit that money can see is one kind of thing. Other ideas along this line, or, you know, there's other things about, you know, opposition to child labor, picking up on the lengthy conversation from last night we were having in the forum. Discrimination, a number of practices. There are others that...
Well, one of the things that's, I think, growing, at least in our community, is the number of our own high school children that are working more and more hours during high school, not during high school time necessarily, but it's taking away from them getting a decent education because for whatever the reason is, they feel a need to work. And it's to some extent turning into the same kind of thing that we're seeing or criticizing other countries where we have children working.
That's a good point, because unemployment is so low, I think there's a new pressure on teens to fill those service jobs.
Mm-hmm. And people are getting excused from school early, if on last class period or whatever, if they've got a job. You know, that's happening in our community quite a bit.
Any other concerns here?
Something along this line has been an issue quite within the last few months, built in Los Angeles and Pasadena, where we are, for the living wage versus the minimum wage. And one of the big arguments against the living wage is we're going to cut out all these teenagers, particularly the teenagers of the affluent, who are just going to get jobs to get more affluence. And therefore, of course, companies can't afford it. So I think it's a very interesting issue. Why are teenagers working? Is it because on the other end of it, I'm waiting to get to the point where our standard of living is unsustainable in this world. And what are we going to do about that? Somebody last night had mentioned that when the standard of living somewhere else comes up, and I'm not, you know, the standard of living cannot come up to our level. The world will be gone if we try to do it. So what is it we're doing when we talk about these things?
I'm going to pass on a little chart and get us a little bit into that. We were going to talk more about the sufficiency theme today, and maybe some of this may carry over to tomorrow. Some of you are here for that. But this is, it's a little diagram that's published in here. Some of you have the original citation on the side from a book by David Horton. And I think it gets at exactly the kind of challenge that's being raised here when we talk about, well, not just sustainability, but even sufficiency. Mm-hmm. What is sufficient? And it's very interesting looking at this diagram here at Holden, because regardless of the lifestyle that most of us might normally live, probably much of which is over on the left side, at least for me it is, and then all of the practices that are really in the center column here at Holden, and how much Holden is a place to model, to live some of that out. And yet, looking at the far cry that still is from the column on the right, the 1.1 billion who are excluded from sufficiency, and the forms of life, and that whole concept of sufficiency is so context dependent.
Yes,
it's a slippery kind of concept, you know, not only depending on what country you live in, but what community. You know, what is sufficient for those of us who live in big cities, in contrast to sufficiency for those who might live in small town rural areas, you know, just basic things like cost of housing. Community of Chicago I live in, you really can't buy even a townhouse for less than $200,000 anymore. And you know what that means for middle class, not to mention lower income people trying to find a place to live. You know, and I don't think of myself living in a particularly affluent community, but a lot more expensive places in the Chicago area than that. But you know, just what those standards are, and to constantly remind ourselves of where we sit in relationship to the rest of the world. Any comments about questions and issues that this kind of chart evokes for you?
Are the numbers supposed to be dividing the world's population?
That's right.
No.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. This was from early 90s.
Okay.
So that's the, I think, coordinates put together with data from the World Watch Institute and a number of other organizations to come up with this particular.
What is this U.S. $7,500 per capita? Is that what does that mean?
That's what it would take to, quote, live lightly.
Per month, per year.
Now, I think the 700 there is awfully low. I mean, maybe 7,500 per person. I mean, if one thinks of a family of three living on, what would that be, about 22,000?
Yeah, but again, it depends where.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Certainly in Southern California, the housing alone. That's pretty true, that looks like every time.
It strikes me, especially with young children, how terribly difficult it is to carry, not to have consumer values in our culture. I mean, it's just a constant, constant bombardment. You know, even I think I try and live fairly conscientiously, and that I feel like I'm certainly raising over-consuming kids.
How to resist those pressures? You know, what this is, in a sense, proposing, and again, this isn't an extensive discussion, it's just trying to raise up some basic principles, but how communities, at page 13, line 17, how communities of faith need to explore together how to resist the promotion of unnecessary consumerism and to live simpler lives. I mean, I think this is an example where, picking up from last night's forum on Christians saying no, you know, are there ways that we can much more intentionally do some of that, you know, grappling with that and talking about what that means in the life of our congregations? I don't think it's the kind of thing that can be a kind of law that's imposed, but you know, how do we deal with those challenges? How do we deal with the inordinate problems with regard to credit, the buildup of credit, you know, whether it's credit card debt, it's been interesting because in some places in the country, feedback we got from, you know, whether it was from farming communities or other communities saying, please speak to the huge problem of credit and how, you know, for how many of our citizens that whole matter of a sustainable livelihood is being undercut because of the huge load of credit.
Or the country, the amount of money the government would have if it wasn't paying off its interest for other programs. I mean, that's the whole. I mean, that to me is the healthy thing of producing the best. I don't understand it all, but that's the simplistic way of looking at it.
I want you to make sure and notice that page 13, line 23, is probably the most, the strongest theological judgment that's set forth in this particular document. The unlimited accumulation of money and wealth as ends in themselves is sinful, especially when this occurs at the cost of human beings, their communities, and the environment. And here is the word against the huge excessive compensations on ways of more proportionally benefiting all those way company employees and all of them therefore contribute to the company's profitability. The paragraph after that is another one of these kind of aspiration kinds of things. This doesn't get into a big discussion of what's happened with financial markets and institutions, and I don't presume to understand all of that myself. But this incredible wild speculation and the way in which money, literally moves, from one place to another with just, $1 trillion a day or something like that, with just incredible rapidity and with real impact on the livelihood and future of communities. Part of what this is saying, well, we don't necessarily have the answer how that's all going to be stopped, but somehow we need to search for some kind of way of holding that in check. There needs to be some conversation of just this free-reigning flow of money and any ways to restrain that. I know in a lot of circles of what makes the world go economically, even to mention that is anathema. I dare you mention that possibility. So this may be unrealistic at this point, but I think it's another one of those cases where, as church, we need to ask some of those hard questions. You may not always have the answer right away, but if in fact we are to look at some of those danger signs on the horizon and not just kind of passively sit back and say, oh, well, there goes the steel ball, there goes this huge monster that's reshaping our world. How do we speak to that? It's interesting, one of the things here, and one of the farmers on our task force is actually from the Morehead area, looks like you were from Fargo. And we did put in here the challenge to concentrate the market power of large agribusiness corporations. I wanted to talk about a lot of other concentrated power too. But the way in which, at least as I understand it, the kind of havoc that that's wrecking for many farmers, and we feel literally in bondage to some of these large agribusinesses, and the way in which prices are determined and all the rest. How can we as church take a stand against something? Any final comments on this last? I think our time is up anyway, and this will be continued. I hope many of you will come back tomorrow. I think it's, in the afternoon or the evening, but we'll be getting much more into the discussion of sustainability and probably carrying over a bit from the sufficiency, because the two, in a sense, work together. There is the need for enough, but not too much in terms of the sufficiency. But then, what can be sustained over time, and how do both of these two criteria need to come into view when we think through what it means to seek God's justice in relationship to economic life and how that affects all people. So, thanks for participating and seek me out if you have some other ideas between now and tomorrow, and we'll continue the discussion tomorrow. If you don't want your little slip of paper, you can leave it here. We recycle everything around here, but you're welcome to take it with you if you'd like to.